Welcome back, everyone, to another edition of the Prove Me Wrong podcast. Once again, and as always, I'm your host, Pete Lieb. We are having a bit of a history lesson tonight, so I'm glad you're all with me. The Kennedys have been referred to as basically American royalty. They're an incredibly wealthy, powerful, and well-known family, especially in the early to mid-20th century. I touched on some of the tragedies and scandal surrounding the family on previous podcasts, and I've teased that I would devote more time to the story in the future, and tonight's the night. I'm very pleased tonight to have author and researcher Donald Jeffries back with me once again, and we are going to discuss the Kennedy family history more in depth. The triumphs, the scandals, the tragedies. Donald has been a JFK assassination researcher since the mid-70s and a family historian as well. He is also the author of several best-selling nonfiction books, including Survival of the Richest, How the Corruption of the Marketplace and the Disparity of Wealth Created the Greatest Conspiracy of All, Crimes and Cover-ups in American Politics, 1776 to 1963, and his newest book that was released in January of this year, Bullyocracy, How the Social Hierarchy Enables Bullies to Rule Schools, Workplaces, and Society at Large. And we have actually had a podcast about that. If you look back in the Prove Me Wrong podcast archives, you can find that one and take a listen to that as well. Don has been on the podcast again several times now. He's a friend of the show, and I'm pleased to have him with me here tonight. You can find more on Don on his blog, donaldjeffries.wordpress.com, and you can find his books on amazon.com as well. So once again, welcome, Don, back to the Prove Me Wrong podcast.
Well, thanks for having me, Pete. It's good to be back.
So it's difficult to find a good place to start when we're talking about the overall history of the Kennedys. It is such a large topic. So I would figure we just start with Joe. You know, he's you know, while the family was there in the U.S. prior to Joe Sr., he's really the basis, in my opinion, of that royalty. He amassed the huge fortune, the power, the wealth, ultimately the legacy. So if you don't mind, can we kind of start there with him and maybe briefly touch on his father, his grandfather, who came in originally?
Sure. I think, yeah, the Kennedy family as we know it, the American royalty family, it really begins with Joe Kennedy Sr. And he was the first Kennedy to really rise above circumstances. I mean, they came over as poor Irish immigrants in the, you know, in the 19th century. And Joe Kennedy, I believe he was a bank president at age 25. I think, if I remember correctly, he was the youngest bank president in the country.
Wow.
Maybe in history. I think he was 25 years old. So he was a very ambitious, went to Harvard and everything, first family ever to do that and set a family tradition there. And he was, early on, he campaigned for Franklin Roosevelt, for the 1932 presidential, good Democrat. And like Huey Long, my all-time political hero, they originally backed Roosevelt, but Huey Long certainly became very disenchanted with FDR, and Joe Kennedy Sr. did as well. And I think he was disappointed, first of all, because he expected, because of the monetary support he gave to the campaign, and he gave his name, you know, for the support to the mm-hmm. campaign, I think he thought he'd be named Secretary of Treasury or some kind of plum position like that. Instead, Roosevelt, I believe he originally appointed him to the SEC Commission, I believe, the Stock and Exchange Commission, I believe, which was, you know, really a step down from something like Secretary of the Treasury.
Right.
So kind of, but Kennedy did a good job on it. And then he appointed him ambassador to Great Britain. That's where most people remember him from. And he took his huge family, you know, he had a bunch of kids, including JFK and Bobby Kennedy and Teddy Kennedy, over to England. They kind of took England, this big Irish Catholic family that kind of took Great Britain by storm. They became, you know, the tabloids. I don't know if they really had tabloids of the day, but whatever they had, they filled them up with stories about the Kennedy family, this big boisterous family. But while he was over there, he started making enemies. And because he was, he recognized what was happening, the war drums were already starting to beat in Europe. And at that time, Hitler, I find a saying, and, you know, again, that if Adolf Hitler had died in, say, 1937, even 1938, he would probably recognize or remembered as Germany's greatest leader and one of the world's greatest men. Because up until that point, he really had revitalized the German economy. And he was Time Magazine Man of the Year. And it wasn't until he suddenly started veering off and invading Poland and France and all this stuff that, you know, it became a whole different ballgame. But Joe Kennedy Sr. was a genuine anti-war activist, and JFK had it, you know, in his blood that he would later become, I believe, the most peace-loving president we ever had. He came by it naturally, and he Joe Kennedy Sr. was attached to the America First Committee, as were lots of other liberals of the day. Most people don't realize, they think this was run by Nazis or something, but no, it was run by American liberals, and who were did not want us to mistake, because they remembered World War One, and the millions of people that died for absolutely nothing. No one can, you know, what did they die for? We don't know. So they didn't want to repeat that mistake, and they said, no, we got to stay out of European affairs. These are madmen over there. We have nothing to do with them. And Joe Kennedy Sr. was very eloquent on these, and, you know, I've got young boys, and he recognized with his oldest son, Joe Kennedy Jr., who was the apple of his eye, and this was the one he was grooming to be a politician. He was terrified, as we all would be, and Jack, of course, that his two oldest sons would be in harm's way, and as it turned out, unfortunately, he had good reason to fear that. So after Joe Kennedy, and of course, his talk, appeasement talk, as they smeared people who wanted peace in those days, and you still hear that name used, appeasers. His friendliness with Neville Chamberlain, his opposition to a young Winston Churchill, who was, you know, the biggest, most boisterous voice for war in Great Britain at the time, got back to Roosevelt, and of course Roosevelt began to resent him too, and so eventually they became political enemies, and this is why later on, if you look at JFK when he ran for president, there's good reason why the old guard of the Democratic establishment did not back him. And they did everything they could to try to stop him. Most people don't realize what John F. Kennedy did. He set the tone for all modern political presidential candidates when he went through the primary process. And I believe there weren't many primaries then. I think he won 7 in a row or something like that. But nobody had done it that way before. Before, the candidates were picked in the back rooms and at the conventions. JFK set the tone for a new type of a process. And they resent because the old guard did not want him. Eleanor Roosevelt was still alive. She opposed JFK, and she remembered because her husband despised the old man. Harry Truman hated him because Harry Truman hated his old man. Adlai Stevenson originally didn't support him. He grew to support him. But this is all because of Joe Kennedy Sr., who made a lot of what I consider the right enemies.
So can I ask you a little bit about Joe Kennedy's earlier years as well? And I know you said that he was a bank president in his early 20s, but there was also, and I don't know how much truth there is to it. I mean, there was also a lot of rumor or innuendo regarding him and, you know, being involved in bootlegging. And I mean, it's almost like a well-known secret. I mean, I think they even have representations of him on popular television shows. I mean, they had a Joe Kennedy character on what was Boardwalk Empire, the HBO show, and he was a bootlegger. How much truth is there to that about him, that he made a lot of his actual fortune bootlegging, and it wasn't really the above board business ventures?
Well, this is the popular impression of him.
Yeah.
And the culture. And I would urge people to, I mean, I certainly went into this a little bit in my book, Hidden History. I wrote a lot about the Kennedys there, and I went into it a little bit. But Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who I think is the most courageous Kennedy to come along since they killed RFK, is getting bolder and bolder now. But his recent book, and I wish I remembered the name, Family, something about American values or something like that. But he wrote, it's a remarkable book because he talks about growing up Kennedy. And he talks about Joe Kennedy Sr. And he says the same thing basically I've always said, that the things about him being a bootlegger, his associations with the mafia, all these kinds of things. If you look at where the sources for all those allegations originally, they all are either from the CIA or from the mafia. These are all taints and people who hated him. They came from, and again, so many people hated him. I don't think there is any evidence for that. I understand about the 1960 election and Joe Kennedy bought the election for his son. Again, you know, I think that's largely myth, especially when we compare the usual political corruption. If that happened, it was nothing compared to some of the other, certainly with landslide Lyndon Johnson's 1952 Senate campaign, something like that, where it's like 7 recounts and the dead voted in droves, things like that. Huge corruption. And eventually a judge, Hugo Black, former KKK leader, who then became a liberal Supreme Court judge, he just approved and just gave the election to Johnson. That's how Johnson had their Senate. So something like that, but that's not talked about by the same historians. They always talk about Mayor Daley, and the Seventh Ward, or whatever it was, where they claim that these votes came from that tipped the Illinois to JFK in 1960. Right. I just look at they're the same sources that talk about him being a bootlegger. And I looked at, you know, having read biographies on Joe Kennedy Sr., I think, and having written a book like Survival of the Richest, which is very critical of the elite, the 1%, the very wealthy, Joe Kennedy Sr., I think, is the most admirable man that accumulated that much wealth that I've ever found.
Wow. Okay.
I think he was remarkably moral. I mean, if you read what his children absolutely worshiped him. And it wasn't, they didn't, I mean, they went to the father, not the mother. I mean, Rose Kennedy wasn't a bad person either, but Joe Kennedy Sr. was the dynamo. He's the one that established that Kennedy competitive drive. I mean, he began, you know, he had this huge family, and he would assign them, like, to talk about current events at dinner. He made sure they learned about all, like, although he was a rather conservative guy, he was later a good friend with Joe McCarthy. But he made sure, like, Joe Kennedy Jr., Jack Kennedy, Bobby Kennedy, Teddy Kennedy, he made sure they got to learn under very liberal socialist teachings, because he wanted them exposed to different things. So I would have loved to have met him. And I just having read about him, I think he was a remarkable, unique individual. And I think he wanted to be president himself.
Okay.
And there are rumors that he was going to challenge FDR for the 1940 nomination. And I can't get much information about it, but when he came back from Great Britain, he met with FDR as soon as he got off the plane. And when he came out of that meeting, he suddenly changed his tune and said he was supporting FDR again. Now, you know, the conspiracy theorist in me tells me, I don't know, they made him some kind, I don't know. They made him an offer he couldn't refuse or something, but he certainly changed, and he dropped any future aspirations for the presidency, which was unusual because he was a very ambitious guy. And then he began to place all his ambitions in his oldest son, Joe Kennedy Jr. Now, when Joe Kennedy Jr. died, the first Kennedy death, and, you know, I believe supposedly he blew up in midair. Mm-hmm. On a top secret kind of a strange, we're not really sure what was going on. Some people claim they were testing early drones. I don't know. Theories abound about it, but a hair on his head was ever found. No trace of him was ever found. So whatever happened devastated the old man, because he was depressed for, you know, mm-hmm. a very long, naturally, because this, he placed all his ambitions in his, I mean, if you see pictures of Joe Kennedy Jr., I mean, the Kennedys, all of them are good looking, but he was the best looking one. He was movie star. I mean, JFK Jr. was obviously a great looking guy, but Joe Kennedy Jr. was better looking. And he was a natural. Jack Kennedy was an introvert who wanted to be a journalist. He really did not have an appetite, as strange as it seems, because he became, like, you know, the template for every modern politician, but he was not natural at it. He learned it. And he felt the pressure. And again, how much they admired the old man. Because he basically, you know, he would tell his friends, look at the old man, look at him. He's got his eyes on me now. He felt the pressure that he had to do this to please him. And he had that much respect and love for him that he did. So he went into something he wasn't a natural for. And he became, obviously, a politician we still look back on, just with his inflections and, you know, mm-hmm. hand gestures and just a remarkable way he could turn a phrase, but that wasn't a natural thing. So, but he lost Joe Kennedy Jr., got in a memorable altercation in the White House with Harry Truman, where he called Roosevelt a crippled son of a bitch, and, you know, got Harry Truman all upset and everything, because he thought that, you know, that they were responsible for him dying. He was bitter. Then he loses his oldest daughter, Kathleen, in a separate plane crash during the war as well. So two children, separate plane crashes, that's enough to devastate any parent, right?
You know, and that's the conspiracy theory in probably both of us. When you're talking about not really finding any evidence of his dealings being below board, but then he shows back up, they have a discussion, suddenly he drops the ambitions he had previously. Why did he do that? Maybe because some of those dealings were not above board, and this is the way to say, okay, you drop what you're doing here, and that won't come into light. You'll keep this fortune that you've amassed. You'll keep your political standing, your social standing, and right. And will go on. So then you know, there is this dual-edged sword, because the Kennedys were on this pedestal, but yet there were just almost constant series of tragedies that occurred to the family, and just really kind of just destroyed the family. It's so odd to me that somebody's so revered and so loved and admired, and then it just systematically, boom, 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 people are in accidents, or they're assassinated, or unfortunately, like Rosemary. I think Rosemary was one of the things.
I was going to bring that up there, because that's another, and that happened right after that, because Rosemary was, she was born in the parlance of the time, she was a little slow, especially for a family like that. This is a high achieving family. They're dynamos, they're competitive, and they're in the public eye. They were presented at court to the queen, you know, that kind of thing. And Rosemary was as well. But Rosemary was the most beautiful of the six. She was a gorgeous woman. Yeah. And I don't know what, she might have even been an early autistic or something. Who knows? I don't know. But she certainly could do everything. But at a certain point, she was really good looking, and the boys were starting to notice her, and they couldn't control her anymore. And they were scared she was wandering off at night and things like that. Mm-hmm. So I think Joe Kennedy Sr. acted in her best interest. He, because of his wealth, he had access to what was then a cutting edge new technology. And this was a frontal lobotomy procedure. Now, of course, we know now that obviously it was not something anybody should want.
Right.
They didn't know at the time. So he acted, and he didn't tell his wife. And again, this was the time where, especially a man in his position.
Right. He didn't challenge the man.
No, his wife was totally subservient. He made all those decisions. And he wanted to surprise her. His idea was to get her fixed. You know, because that's what the doctors told him. She'll be great. She'll be right up to snuff and the same level with your other daughters. So he thought, it's great. You know, I can surprise. Won't Rosemary? You know, my wife. Won't she be surprised? So that was his idea, and so he acted in her best interest. And he certainly didn't want what happened to have happened. And his tragedy is, for all intents and purposes, she was killed because the lobotomy backfired
right.
and made her at the level of a 2 or 3 or 4 year old. So, and then they ended up putting her away. And again, that was something, that's what people did then. I can tell you, I had a niece born with Down syndrome in 1968, and everybody wanted to put her away then. Hmm. And this is, you're talking about the 1940s. And especially when you had the kind of financial resources the Kennedys had. That's what they did. They put her in a nunnery, I believe it was, and the nuns watched her. So, and they've been criticized for that. I've gotten into so many debates about that. I said, you know what, do you think he wanted this to happen to his daughter?
Yeah.
But there's so many, but they people believe when they demonize somebody, and he has become demonized. And they believe, and I don't know what they're believing. It's like, look, everything on the record says this guy was a great father. His parents adored him. He pushed them. Yeah. But, he did. There's no evidence that he ever abused them or anything. And his grandchildren loved him. You read Bobby Kennedy Jr.'s book. I mean, he talks about some remarkable stories for this. But so he effectively lost Rosemary as well.
Mm-hmm.
But I think unfairly criticized for that. And then, of course, by the time that, you know, we know about the assassinations of John and then RFK. So you're talking about 4 unnatural deaths of his children. And if you throw in Teddy Kennedy, people forget
right.
he was in a plane crash. He survived. But so that's 3 plane crashes. 3 separate plane. Imagine you have three of your kids are in 3 separate plane crashes. I mean, I don't know how you would even calculate those odds.
And then John Jr. also in a
yes.
plane crash and
exactly.
passing in a plane crash as well.
Exactly.
Yeah, they've had the bad luck with planes. But just to go back briefly to Rosemary, you're right. Yeah, he has been. And again, we're talking depictions on popular television shows and things like that.
Yes.
Joe Kennedy is almost always a bastard. He's almost always a
yes.
bad guy, always yeah. depicted that way. And yeah, you're right. It's easy to look back now and say, man, that lobotomy went terribly wrong. You're a terrible person for doing it. But yes, putting yourself back into the medical understanding of the time, it was considered a brand new, cutting edge procedure.
Miracle
sometimes
care.
It went well and sometimes
yeah.
it didn't. So it's also depending on how well the person who is performing it does, how well they do it. So there's so many, when you start messing with people's brains, there's so many things that can go wrong.
Yeah.
But, so I would tend to agree that no father, because I've also read stories where when she was in high school, and she's still, you know, she's reading at maybe a fifth grade level or what have you. She's again, a little slow, as you say, at that age. But they didn't want her to feel odd at the dance. And so her brother went to the dance and was dancing with her to make sure that she felt included and part of the process. And I think if her father was ashamed of her or didn't love her or wanted to be rid of her, they wouldn't have done those type of steps prior.
They included her on everything.
Yeah.
Because she was presented at court to the queen with the rest of them. She had a debutante. She was not treated any differently. And the Kennedys, again, if you look at them, I compare them to other families and 1%. I think they had less dysfunction. They had more tragedy, but the dysfunction, there doesn't appear to be any. The siblings were always very close. They loved their parents. The grandchildren loved the grandparents and so forth. So I think that he, for whatever reason, Joe Kennedy Sr. has been cast this way in history. And I think a lot of it, again, has to do with the fact he opposed World War II. Mm-hmm. And anybody that opposed World War II is demonized in popular culture, because that's considered the good war, and which, you know, I'm like Benjamin Franklin. I don't believe there is such a thing as a good war or bad peace. But most of our court historians believe that. So because he was on the wrong side, Jack Kennedy took, you know, he went through all the liberal indoctrination and everything. And I think that the establishment, I'm shocked that they let him get the nomination. Knowing his history, because as it turns out, obviously they decided they made a mistake too, because they had to end up, censoring him. What George Bernard saw, the ultimate assassination, is the most ultimate form of censorship, mm-hmm. and they decided they had to get rid of this guy. But he was his father's man. The Joe Kennedy Sr. also was one of the first critics of the Federal Reserve. And he understood what the Federal Reserve was, and I'm sure they spent lots of time around the table. He spent lots of time talking to his boys about the Federal Reserve, because, you know, money was a huge subject with them. And again, this is, if you want to know why people are demonized, Joe Kennedy Sr. opposed World War II. He understood about the Federal Reserve. Those are two reasons right there.
Why, so he's basically un-American right there. Because there's a huge American push during World War II. If you're American, you are for the war effort. And absolutely, anybody who's in the know understands in terms of the Federal Reserve and actually how terrible the Federal Reserve has actually been forever. So yeah, I can see it. And you're right. The court of public opinion lasts forever. And again, unfortunately, even as I watched that Chappaquiddick movie, even maybe 2 years ago, and again, he was exactly, it was a consistent portrayal of what Joe Kennedy Sr. is.
There's never, until Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s book recently, and my little contribution in hidden history and what mm-hmm. I've tried to, his book especially really was an attempt, I think, and a very admirable attempt on his part. And of course, his family loyalty, it's his grandfather, so naturally. Right. But I think he made a lot of points that made sense, that a lot of this isn't. It's the same kind of mythology that is created, after the assassinations, you had a period of time where there was this Camelot, this vision of Camelot, and the Kennedys were briefly mythologized and turned into kind of shining, superheroes, mm-hmm. brief, but it was a very brief period of time. And after Robert F. Kennedy was assassinated, certainly after Chappaquiddick, the Kennedy family began to be looked at differently. And by the time the mid-70s came around with Judith Campbell Exeter, and I've written a lot, Jim DiEugenio is another guy who's written a lot about this subject as well. I relied on his research when I was writing about this in Hidden History. But Judith Campbell Exeter was not a credible person at all. And most people don't realize when she suddenly came into the public eye with these stories, she never even mentioned the mafia at first. And so, but then later she began embellishing it, and no one in the same media that was smearing anybody that says there was a conspiracy to kill JFK instantly accepted these fanciful tales of her that, she was JFK's mistress and also Sam Giancana's mistress. And JFK, the Kennedy administration under Bobby Kennedy's attorney general, was the only presidential administration in history that targeted the mob. And, Bobby Kennedy was, doing really outlandish things. They were, for the right reasons, but, mm-hmm. his methods were ruthless, where he was actually going out and having his people abduct big time mobsters because he couldn't convict them in court because the jurors, would be bought off. So he was having them I believe it was Carlos Macella or Santos Traficante, who both of those figures have been tied into theories. One of those guys was picked up on a street and taken over to Guatemala or something and just dumped in the jungle. So just imagine the pride of these guys. They were treated like that by this little punk Bobby Kennedy, you know. So the mafia despised them. There's the idea that they would have been, you know, allied with Kennedy. And it's based on a few loose things like JFK's friendship with Frank Sinatra.
Mm-hmm.
Personally, and Sinatra's ties to the mob. Okay, so if you want to say that, but that's Sinatra's ties to the mob. There's no evidence. And Bobby Kennedy despised the mafia. But this mythology has been built up that not only do they not talk about all the efforts the Kennedy administration made against the mafia, they actually try to make it seem as if the mafia put them in power. And then they called in some favors on the old man because of what they did to help win Illinois. And mm-hmm. and this is the myth. And nobody ever delves into it. It's just accepted. Like you said, the portrayal of Joe Kennedy Sr. is always the same. And then once they began to rewrite the record on JFK, then you get today, you have people on the left like Noam Chomsky who hate Kennedy and who don't care at all about his assassination and try to rewrite the record and say, no, he wasn't going to withdraw from Vietnam, which is BS. We know from the National Security Act Memorandum 263, he absolutely was. It's documented.
Mm-hmm.
But they just pretend that doesn't exist. And they say, so basically they're trying to say there was nothing changed and so his death was irrelevant. Ooh. It wouldn't have been any different, which is absolutely not true.
So let's back up for just a moment. And so Joe Jr. blows up. We never see him again. JFK at that point takes over the mantle after Joe passed. JFK did not want that type of life. Did Joe Jr. want that type of life? Or how much of an impact did Sr. have on them in terms of did they feel like they could say to Dad, you know what, Dad, I want to be a journalist. I want to be a photographer. I don't want to be in politics. Or was his influence over them so strong that they didn't even question what he wanted to do?
Joe Jr. absolutely did. He was okay. A chip off the old block, and he was very political, as was JFK. JFK was too. He just was from a journalistic point of view.
Mm-hmm.
But Joe Jr. absolutely did. In fact, he was a delegate to the Democratic National Convention, I guess, of 1944. And so he was already getting his feet wet. There were already plans. Okay, as soon as he, comes out of the war, he's going to run as JFK ended up doing on his war record. And because that's what people did. Now, JFK ended up being a genuine war hero. Again, something they tried. And they've even tried to smear him there. I mean, if you read, and I wrote about this in Hidden History, if you read what he did, by all accounts, is that that he ended up tugging an injured man. He gave his life a preserver to the guy. And he gripped the life preserver in his teeth and swam like 2 miles tugging the guy with his teeth. I mean, I haven't heard of too many more acts of heroism, certainly by any high profile politician than that. That's a real profile in courage.
Wow.
But they dismissed that by saying, yeah, but it was his recklessness. And that's the first example of them saying about the Kennedy recklessness, which would really come into play in the lies about JFK Jr.'s death. This recklessness, this theme, the Kennedys are reckless.
Mm-hmm.
So they claim that he didn't know what he was doing as the captain of PT-109. And because of that, the Japanese, cut the boat in half. And so they blame him instead of crediting him with saving his, that guy, especially his life. They smear him. And a lot of high profile people did too. A lot of politicians who hated Kennedy would still bring that up. But it wasn't true. And he was a genuine war hero. Certainly, we see the mythology built around lots of other politicians who didn't have that kind of record, something like that. But JFK absolutely did. And it goes even after that into the writing profiles of courage, when there's no evidence that JFK was a great writer. It was what he wanted to be. And, he wrote his thesis, Why England Slept. He was a college student. It's very well written. And so there's no reason to think, certainly Theodore Sorensen helped him write it.
Mm-hmm.
But again, people lie and they built up this thing, JFK, they bought that off. And Ted Sorensen wrote the book and his old man made it a bestseller by buying. I mean, there's all kinds of stories about it, but it's a remarkable book. And it's what's more remarkable about it is some of the profiles and courage he lists. And I talked about this in Crimes and Cover-Ups. In American politics, 1776, 1963. Again, people don't realize this, that one of the guys he has as a profound courage is Republican Robert Taft, son of the President Taft, who was Mr. Republican. It's another guy who I believe was cheated out of the 1952 Republican nomination by people like Earl Warren and a young Richard Nixon, who steered it towards Eisenhower. Robert Taft was a great man, a real anti-war guy, a real anti-New World Order guy early mm-hmm. on. He was a really wonderful person. I'm a great admirer of his. But he was one of the eloquent voices at the time to speak up against the Nuremberg Convention. And JFK included Taft as a profile in courage because he had the courage to speak up about the outrage that was the Nuremberg Convention, the Nuremberg trials. Now nobody, and JFK himself condemned it. Now imagine that. You look back now, no one condemned, until I wrote that book, and I for whatever little, impact I had, that was the first time that I know of since JFK's profile in courage that anybody talked about what an absurdity it was to legally put on trial the vanquished in a war, people you beat in battle, mm-hmm. unheard of, unprecedented. Now we look at it as the ultimate justice, but the fact that he chose him, and he chose another guy who, the name escapes me now, who was the one who voted against impeaching impeaching Andrew Johnson, which is another politically incorrect thing to do. Because I have the quotes in the book about these, the people today who talk about how horrible this guy was for voting against Andrew Johnson. So, right. Voting against impeaching him. So he was willing, even at that time, to go against the grain. And he was already starting to show, if they had been paying attention, that he was his father's son. I guess they just didn't realize it until he got to the White House.
So when he comes out of the war, and then directly from there, does he become involved in politics at that point? I think he was in the state of Massachusetts.
1946, yeah. 1946, he became a representative in the House. And he ran for Congress in Boston. And it was going to be easier for Kennedy to win Boston because they had a history there. They had, there was all Honey Fitz, his grandfather on the other side, was, the Kennedy side, there was a Honey Fitz, and there was another guy too that was a mayor of Boston. Mm-hmm. So they're but both sides of his family had some political history there in Boston. So they had a base, and of course Irish politicians were popular. Boston was natural to gravitate to. So and he was he was a war hero, and he had lots of money. So it wasn't, and I don't know how much his dad spent in that campaign, but I'm sure it was well financed.
Yeah.
And it's what else are you gonna spend your money on? But people still had to vote for him. So, and he was a good looking, very skinny kid, but he was but the women loved him even then. So he had a natural, and he was already beginning to find his voice, and he had the cadence down and so forth. And from there, he challenged Henry Cabot Lodge, who was a kind of a long, veteran, I believe it was 1952, for the Senate seat, and upset him. That was when he really began to make national waves, because that was an impressive win. Because mm-hmm. Cabot Lodge was, Back Bay, Boston, and he ended up beating him. And then, of course, by 1956, he almost became the vice presidential nominee with Adlai Stevenson, because that was the last convention. If you can still watch like television highlights of that, but if you watch it, you'll see how different politics used to be, where they used to have vote after vote, and eventually it would be settled. People would swing their delegates here, and that hasn't mm-hmm. happened in a long time. But in that case, JFK almost got the vice presidential nomination, and he didn't. But it did put him center stage, and it propelled him for the 1960 campaign.
And so obviously I am not of an age where I was alive when Kennedy was president. But from all accounts, like to your point, he was transcendent as the president. Few people have left kind of the historical mark that JFK left on the presidency. People are still now playing his speeches now. That's not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country is still relevant now. I think I heard somebody say it the other day, and it's 60, 70 years old now. It had a very short window of time where he was the president, unfortunately. What were some of those accomplishments that he made during those 3 years that he was president? And what problems did those accomplishments present potentially for those who didn't want him around?
Well, I think he started off in the bell because his inaugural address, which I believe was largely written by Ted Sorensen, who was, along with JFK, was the voice of the, and it was really Kennedy's, his voice. Mm-hmm. And it's one of the most remarkable speeches ever. It's not just "That's not what your country," it's just, it, and it, a lot of it is Cold War dogma, because Kennedy started out as a Cold War, that was the tenor of the times. You know, we had to stop Soviet communism and so forth. But it's just there's a lot of idealism in it. And Kennedy was the last idealist of the Kennedys. Robert Kennedy was an idealist as well. And I guess you could go to Ted Kennedy at his speech at the 1980, The Dream Will Never Die, the 1980 convention. That was kind of the last gasp of old fashioned liberalism. Mm-hmm. But Kennedy was an idealist. He had a vision that you don't see in politicians anymore. So I think that although he didn't, his accomplishments were few, actual accomplishments. And that's because he was trying to do some things. But I think if you look at something like the Peace Corps, it was a wonderful idea. And it inspired, I think that was one of the most remarkable parts of his administration, because young people that were, coming out of college and so forth, and they were so inspired by this idea that you volunteer rather than go into service, you go into this and you go into other parts of the world and you try to help. You try to spread a message of goodwill and show what you can do. And that played into the Alliance for Progress, which is the same kind of thing, where he was hoping to stop the spread of communism, especially in Latin American countries. And he also didn't want to go with the Kennedy was always in support of all these nationalist movements. Same thing in Africa. He was one of the first to support nationalist movements in Africa. He was not a colonialist at all or an imperialist. And again, this is why he started making enemies. And he believed that, that you should offer not necessarily military support, but in places like that, the Alliance for Progress, things like that, where they would encourage these kind of independent movements, nationalist movements, so that people could govern themselves. And it really is in keeping with the tradition of the founding of this country, that all people everywhere have a right to consent to those who govern, that people should be responsible for their own government. So this was, we had not seen this before.
Right.
And so that's why, if you look at, although he ended up being hated by a lot of people in this country, even then, around the world, and so many countries, Kennedy is still revered. And it was because of that, because he spoke to the world, his inaugural address. And then when he sent the Peace Corps volunteers, they remembered the young kids coming over there and trying to help out and spread the American idea of freedom and democracy and the Alliance for Progress, that, we're going to support these and we're not going to be working with the CIA to topple and put tin pot dictators in to challenge the communists. So you're not offering them anything better. But Kennedy was, and then of course, he got off on the wrong foot because of the Bay of Pigs. And that happened right at the beginning of his administration. And it was a product of the Eisenhower administration. It was planned. In fact, Richard Nixon was the political head of it as vice president under Eisenhower. And Kennedy came in young and naive. They saw that and they thought they could pull the wool over his eyes. But when they asked him for air support, he said, this is crazy. We're not going to put some kind of full spread. But afterwards and to this day, he is still smeared. I remember getting in many arguments years ago from right-wing people. Kennedy was responsible. He got so many men killed when he pulled air support. He didn't pull air support. He would have never approved it. They just made it look that way. It was a stupid plan. Mm-hmm. It would never have worked. And unfortunately, it created a lot of enemies. And to this day, in the Cuban community, people hate him because of that. And you'll see that. And that's when his assassination happened. We saw a lot of Cuban names involved. And I don't believe they were really part of any conspiracy, but I believe at the lower levels, they were used for various purposes. But certainly they all had antipathy for Kennedy because of the Bay of Pigs. They never forgave him for that. And it was the biggest mistake. But after that, his eyes were open and he wasn't naive anymore. And at that point, that's when he began to really become dangerous to the establishment. Because he made his famous statement, "I'd like to shatter the CIA into 1,000 pieces into the winds," and he was talking about abolishing the CIA. And I said, just consider that if somebody tried to do that now, if Trump or somebody tried to do that, the ramifications of that. He basically started going through Bobby Kennedy, as was his attorney general, and he stopped trusting the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and it was all because of the Bay of Pigs. And then the Cuban Missile Crisis. Same kind of thing happened where he and Bobby were the only people in that room that were against going to war with Cuba. the so, Voices for Peace.
Well, I was literally going to ask you then, what was the trigger? Because I know that we're talking about the assassination, and I know in our previous discussions, you said you have gone through pretty much the entire Warren Commission report, seen all the exhibits, all the evidence. And I think I'm safe to say that you do not believe in the single shooter theory.
No.
So I didn't want to put words in your mouth, but I'm pretty sure we've already said that.
Yeah.
So I was going to ask you, what was the trigger for this conspiracy and for this plan? But again, basically, you just told me right there, right? If when we start talking about we're going to eliminate the CIA and there's a credible threat to actually eliminate the CIA, that alone is enough to say,
well,
we might need to get rid of this person.
Well, I think there were so many possible motives, and people had a motive. Certainly, the CIA had a motive because he wanted to abolish them,
mm-hmm.
you know, and they were Nazi the whole time. People don't realize that there was also this incredibly mad. And when people talk about Sandy Hook and Boston bombing and things like that, oh, you're crazy to think that there would be hoaxes and fakes and stuff like that. Well, go back to Operation Northwoods,
mm-hmm.
1962. This is the CIA Joint Chiefs of Staff. The Joint Chiefs of Staff approved this. CIA wanted to. They wanted to fake plane crashes, fake assassinations. They wanted to. And it's unclear if they were actually going to kill anybody. But the idea was to blame all these mostly or all fake incidents on Cuba as a pretext for war. So that kind of thinking existed in 1962, what the conspiracy theorists in their parents' basements are saying now that are crazy.
Right.
Same kind of thinking existed in the CIA. And yet Kennedy, to his credit, was the only one, again, the Joint Chiefs of Staff approved it. So the only reason it didn't happen is because Kennedy had the rational, you know, sense to say, this is mad. Of course, I'm not going to approve this. So that really, I think, sealed his fate. And of course, National Security Action Memorandum 263, which is a real document. It's not Noam Chomsky. It's not anybody's theory. This is out there. Not only that, but he, in his last press conference, he said the same thing. It delineated a withdrawal from Vietnam. The first 1,000 troops were going to come out by the end of 1963. All troops were going to be out by 1965. So this was in the works. And the greatest evidence, I believe, for an insider conspiracy, including his administration, is National Security Action Memorandum 273, which was drafted on November 22nd, 1963, by his National Security Advisor, McGeorge Bundy, who therefore had to have been some kind of a conspirator, because he had to have known 273 contradicts totally the very recent new plans to withdraw from Vietnam
mm-hmm.
that were delineated in 263. He had to have known JFK would have never signed it and probably would have fired him on the spot for drafting it. So, you know, he had to know he wasn't going to be around to sign it. He had to worry about it. Of course, Lyndon Johnson was only too happy to sign it. So I think the withdrawal from Vietnam, huge reason. His loggerheads with the CIA, huge reasons. He might, you know, if he got reelected, he might very well have abolished the CIA
and
created something different.
And it's funny because you were talking about the conspiracy theory, quote unquote, conspiracy theorists in their basement. That was probably before the CIA actually created the term conspiracy theorist to explain
right.
those people away, right? To debunk
exactly.
them and make them seem ridiculous. And it's so funny to me how many times the conspiracy theorist ends up being right. But people sure. still don't ever put those together. You know, they never actually give them credit and say, well, you know what? Those conspiracy theorists have been right 8 times over the course of
right.
this. But they're not right about this one. This one's the one that right. they're wrong about. So it's always fun to me where people absolutely and without question trust everything that their government tells them. Their government would never do them wrong. Their government always has their best interests at heart
right.
and never think critically about what's happening and what they're seeing with their eyes and who would stand to gain from things happening the way it is. But and at that time, right, the elder Bush was the CIA director. Isn't that correct?
No, he wasn't. He was a young guy at that time. There's a little memo out there. A lot of people, I don't know what it means, but there is something signed by George Bush to the CIA around mm-hmm. right before the assassination of Kennedy. So its indications are that he had some affiliation. He would later become director of the CIA, I believe under President Ford.
Okay.
Right around that time, 76, something like that. But, So at that time he wasn't, and I purposely don't name names, and people want to say this guy did it, that guy did it. But I think that Oliver Stone did a really good job of portraying what probably happened. If you look at Mr. X's, played by Donald Sutherland's speech, who was a composite figure based on Fletcher Prouty, who was a member of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and was privy to all this. I think he explained it pretty well. There's something in the air. A bunch of people come together. A lot of people with mutual interest came together. People in the Pentagon, people like General Curtis LeMay, people like that, the real hardliners who hated Kennedy over his actions at the Bay of Pigs and during the Cuban Missile Crisis, who wanted a big war in Vietnam. They had every reason. The Pentagon brass definitely wanted him gone. The CIA certainly wanted him gone. I mean, people like Alan Dulles, who ended up becoming a member of the Warren Commission. I mean, he fired Alan Dulles and Richard Bissell, the top two members, the director, Alan Dulles, and his assistant, Richard Bissell, after the Bay of Pigs. You know, he put it out there. Hey, it's your fault. I'm firing you. And he said, you know, one of us has to go. I'm the president, so I'm firing you. And Dulles never, this was a proud man. Mm-hmm. And so he's later assigned to, and all evidence shows he was the most active member of the Warren Commission. So he had a tremendous influence over that investigation. So, you know, it was never, nothing ever, it was investigated about the CIA because it might have uncovered his own complicity there. So I think that certainly the CIA and J. Edgar Hoover, who really led the cover up. If you look at, you know, when I was studying these things, and, you know, Harold Weisberg was a great critic who I had the pleasure of meeting one day in the early 1980s, had dinner at his house, but he wrote tons of self-published books in the days before books weren't self-published. And it's literally his wife typed them up. You know, he showed me the typewriter where she typed them up, and you bought them through the mail. I bought them all that way. And, but they're wonderful pieces of research in the days before the internet. But Weisberg spent every one day of his life for probably the last 20 years of his life trudging into court on a bus every day to file Freedom of Information Act lawsuits to try to unearth documents here and there from the FBI and other agencies. And what he's published over and over again was how J. Edgar Hoover's FBI especially would Xerox copies of copies of copies. It's basically to make whatever they finally released almost illegible. And, you know, you don't do that unless you're covering something up. And that was the FBI. Hoover hated Kennedy's. Certainly he was, whether he knew ahead of time, same thing with LBJ. Whether he knew ahead of time, both of them would have approved and been very happy that he was being killed. So, you know, if you look at possible conspirators, the Secret Service, they stood down. They did nothing to stop the assassination. They had 6 seconds to react. They didn't react at all.
So you see how hard, this is. Everything you just said there, it just keeps piling up on itself. You see how hard this is to swallow, because we're talking about someone has to get the head of the FBI, the head of the CIA. You're talking about Joint Chiefs of Staff. You're talking about high level individuals in the government. You're talking about the vice president. I mean, my assumption is the vice president hates him. He's got to be the ringleader. He's got to be the one that brings it to
right.
the rest.
Well, a lot of people think that, yeah.
I mean, that's just the logical thing is.
Right.
But that's why a conspiracy like that is so hard to swallow. Again, right. Because you're saying that there is that every one of these people is corrupt. Every one of these people, they essentially engineered, implemented, performed, and then covered up a coup. It was a governmental coup. They removed the acting president. They replaced that president with somebody of their own liking for their own political gain. I think that's where a lot of people have a hard time stomaching the conspiracy part of it.
Well, sure. I mean, I've heard many times someone would have talked. You can't keep a secret.
Yeah.
And, you know, I pointed out people talk all the time. And if you read my books alone, you'll see all the people that talked. A lot of them were killed or died unnaturally when they talked.
Right.
And they have no one to talk to. Because the media, none of this would have been possible without the complicity of the media. If the media had done their job, because the cover-up was shoddy. And as Vincent Salandri, who just recently died, or he was 90 or so recently, dean of critics, as he recognized early on, and I independently recognized, that you know this was a cover-up that was designed to be transparent. They wanted the people to know what they were doing. Otherwise, when they planted the magic bullet, for instance, they would have. Why wouldn't you plant a bullet that looked like it hits something?
Right.
Why would you plant one that everybody would say, "Wait a minute, it's undamaged"? You know, you say it had caused so. But they did this on purpose because, first of all, they like to. It's kind of a game they play, I guess. Maybe they get their kicks out of it. And they understand that no matter how obvious they make it, most people suffer from normalcy bias. And they're not going to believe, as you mentioned, that all these people are involved in some vast conspiracy. And, you know, how these things operate, I don't know. Again, I think that, as you know, Donald Sutherland says in JFK, you know, someone makes a call, somebody else makes another call. And the problem is, it's the same way the media, like Harold Weisberg said, they didn't have to be told to cover it up. They really didn't. They recognize, and even today, they don't really have to be told to, because when they go to journalism school, especially if they go to the Ivy League schools, they're so indoctrinated in avoiding those kind of topics because they're so, you know, immersed in coincidence theory, if you have it, that, you know, that these things are, you know, everything's random and happenstance. You can't keep a secret and all that kind of stuff. So they don't even have to be told. They don't need it. They didn't need to have a big meeting to say, all they had to do, someone had to trigger it. At the ground level, all you needed was the Secret Service. You needed to tell them, and who knows what they told them. There's some evidence that they were told that we're going to have a drill, much as later on in all these recent incidents, like the Boston bombing and all these things, there are drills happening at the same time. And this would possibly explain how they didn't react, because they were told, the president, you know, Kennedy's too reckless. He's not taking this seriously. We're going to have a drill to teach him, hey, he needs to stop, you know, getting out so much and you know, to listen to what we're saying. So if that happened, it might be somewhat understandable. But if you look at, there's a film at the airport, taken at Love Field, Vince Palarama, who's done a lot of great work on this, and my friend who wrote Survivor's Guilt, a very good book about the Secret Service. He interviewed all these people, but he unearthed this film that no one had noticed before. And if you see at the airport, the limousine's about ready to leave. They're just going on there, you know, to road into, you know, disaster. But you can see a Secret Service agent walking by, and he's taking his place alongside. If you look at other motorcades, there's one or two agents that are jogging alongside the car the entire time.
Right.
Not in Dallas. And you can see him like put his hands up and say, what? Like, you can see he's exasperated because he's being called off. And he does. So obviously he wasn't in on it. And he's throwing his hands like, you know, WTF, you know, what's going on? And that guy, I believe, was a man named Henry Ripka. Now, Vince disagrees with me and believes it was somebody else. But I was the first one to talk to his family members. And they had some, you know, people could read in history. It's very interesting reactions. But he died way too young. Nobody knows anything about him. But I believe that film shows, you know, how on the fly this thing was happening, where they didn't. He was not in the loop. They called him off at the last minute. And if you watch Emery Roberts, who is the agent in charge of the back of the Secret Service car, is right behind the presidential limousine. You know, they're you know, you talk about it, it's a hop, skip, and a jump away. So what should have happened when the first shot was fired? The closest agent, at least one of them, should have instantly been off that car, run up, jumped on top of JFK, and knocked him down and barricaded him with his body.
Mm-hmm.
That never happened. 6 seconds went by.
Can I ask you real quick before we get too deep into that? I mean, how common, and it probably was very common, but we don't see it nowadays, and maybe that's why. How common was it for the president at that point to be in a motorcade in a convertible car, driving out, you know, in public like that? You know, nowadays you really don't see that anymore.
No.
Was that a common occurrence back then, that they were usually out in the open like that in public?
Yeah, sometimes he used the bubble top, but yeah. And if you look, and again, Vince Pellerama has done some great work on this, where he's published lots of photos, and you can see how different, how much more security was typically around them. Again, you usually had a couple joggers next site. A lot of times there was one agent at least on the bumper, the rear bumper.
Right.
So there was less of a target. The way it was set up that day, there was nobody on the bumper. And even the motorcycles dropped back. They should have at least been right, you know, basically even with the rear tires. They weren't. There was a clear shot at Kennedy, and that's not supposed to happen. That's the idea of having people on either side of him, that people can still see him. But if there's a sniper in an upper window or something, it's going to make it harder to hit him. So they, as Fletcher Prouty talks about, and, you know, the Donald Sutherland character talks about in Oliver Stone's JFK, a protocol was violated everywhere that day.
Yeah.
And he talks about it everywhere. They weren't they weren't looking in the windows. They weren't there were people on rooftops. I mean, there was, and of course, Roger Craig, who was the only Dallas police officer to do his job that day. He talked about being the sheriff told them that none of them were supposed to be involved with security. They were all backed down and they should have been helping. So, it's very, very strange. And however you look at it, if there had been a real investigation, an honest investigation, the first people that should have been questioned were Emory Roberts, who there's evidence indication that he called off. There was one of the agents, Jack Reddy, who was on there before Clint Hill belatedly ran after the shots were done and jumped on the car as a meaningless gesture. I mean, Kennedy's head was already blown off and they made him into a hero. He wasn't a hero, but Jack Reddy, John Reddy, tried to get off the car and do his job, and Emory Roberts called him back. Now, that's inexcusable. So if you had a real investigation, Emory Roberts would have been one of the first witnesses called. And they would have said, what were you doing? Why? And they would have talked all the secret. And there's evidence they were out drinking the night before, past hours, which violated the protocol. So these are the kind of things that would have been one of the first things they would have done, because, the Secret Service allowed the assassination to happen by their incompetence. But nothing ever happened. They were instead made to be heroes, and they certainly were never taken to task for it.
Well, I mean, to me, the real hero of that entire thing, forget the Secret Service agent who jumped up, the real hero to me was Jackie. Because
yes.
Jackie, how many people in that situation would have just cowered in the back of the seat and got small?
Right.
She literally is climbing on the back of the car trying to rescue pieces of his skull while shots are going on around her. I mean, that's badass. I mean, no doubt at all. I mean, you cannot dispute the fact that the guts that woman had to have. Bullets are flying around her, and she's not hiding. She's not getting small in the back seat of the car. She's literally trying to grab pieces of her husband that have been blown off and trying to put them back in place. And no, I don't think anybody ever really even registers that that's what she's doing. She's literally climbing out to rescue pieces of him. I mean, that's so amazing to me. That speaks to her character and to her her strength, quite honestly. But I did. I also saw video in what movie it was. It was a movie regarding the Zapruder film and some discrepancies in the film. But then they also posed the theory that the car even slowed down prior to that final shot. It slowed down because you saw the motorcycle police actually roll up on it quickly because the car had actually slowed. It wasn't the motorcycle that was speeding up. It was the car that was slowing down that made it seem like the motorcycle came up on it, as if posing him for that final shot. And that's
Well, 57 different witnesses, unconnected to each other, testified that the motorcade stopped or nearly stopped. And again, as Donald Sutherland's character points out, this violated all protocol. They're not supposed to do that. And first of all, the hairpin, the turn they made in front of the depository violated protocol. And there's you go into the fact that they changed the motorcade route at the last minute. They still lie and claim they didn't. They did. And you can look in Jim Garrison's book, On the Trail of the Assassins. He published the exhibit where they blacked out the motorcade route in the newspaper at that time because they didn't want to see that it was the old route. But they had a straight shot to go under the triple underpass, which would have been a normal way to go. But instead, they had this route where they had, especially the turn in front of the book depository, which made no sense and violated their Secret Service because it required them to slow down at least some to make the turn. But and then if you look at the color film, you'll see the brake lights come on.
Mm-hmm.
And that's another thing. Another witness that should have been grilled mercilessly was William Greer, who was the driver. And he was not the regular driver. He was a replacement driver. And again, Vince Palorama interviewed his son later. And very interesting what he said. Like he said, what did your dad think of Kennedy? And it was an awkward silence. And finally he said, well, we were Protestants and he was Catholic.
Hmm. So that's the justification.
I mean, what does that tell you? But
wow.
You can even see Greer smiling inappropriately in some photos. And, the first thing, Pete, that got me interested in the JFK assassination, really interested, was reading a book called Johnny, We Hardly Knew You, which was written, it was not a book about the assassination per se, but it was written by his Kennedy's closest aides, Kenny O'Donnell and Dave Powers. And it was a New York Times bestseller, great book, all about his political career. But they went into depth about the assassination. And although they didn't really critique anything, they didn't really come out for conspiracy, they painted a picture of LBJ that really stayed with me, the way he acted. And that's the first thing that made a lot of people suspicious. Certainly when I was a 7-year-old kid when it happened, and I remember my very Catholic family cussing Johnson and talking about him because of the way he just looked so unnatural, and he couldn't contain his happiness. Mm-hmm. He could, and his crazy wife, if you look at the pictures of the swearing-in ceremony, she looks just goofy. She's got an absurd smile on her face that's so out of character to the moment. She couldn't stop herself. And then, so these kinds of things. And of course, I would love to have talked to Evelyn Lincoln, who was JFK's personal secretary and was a very great conspiracy theorist later, but you know, she died unfortunately in the '90s before I, you know, really started getting anything published. But, she told researchers, that on the way back to Washington from Dallas, that LBJ people like Jack Valenti and Liz Carpenter, who was press secretary, were whooping it up and celebrating. Now, you know, either she's lying or that's incomprehensible to us.
Right.
But that, and you see a lot of that in LBJ's, and you saw William Greer at one point. There's a photo of him coming out. You know, that day, and he's got a smile on his face. I mean, this is a guy that, you know, that he was supposedly so torn up and everything. And, you know, Jackie Kennedy later made some comment about it, and that driver, you know, said, you know, but the idea that you're trained, the sound of gunfire, he should have been off instantly. He should have sped out of there. Instead, he not only slowed down or stopped, the Zapruder film shows him turn around completely and look in the back seat and watch Kennedy's head get blown off. I mean, so real investigation, Secret Service, Bill, William Greer, they're grilled.
Yeah.
And say, you know, what are you doing? And you would have shown the Zapruder film. What are you doing here? Why are you turning around? Is that what your protocol says to do? None of that happened. They were handled with kid gloves. And that's why people believe that it was this big conspiracy, because a real investigation wouldn't have been conducted that way.
So he was a replacement driver, but he was still a Secret Service driver.
Yes, he was still capable of doing
so,
the job.
So it wasn't like me or a layperson who may have frozen. You know, that's a logical thing. If you hear things going around you, you might have frozen. Your foot might have come off the gas a little bit.
Right.
But in that situation, even though he's the replacement, he was more than capable and trained to hit the gas and go. Okay.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. So, you know, a real investigation was never conducted. And that's why when people say it was a benign, benign cover up and there were rogue elements involved. No, I think this was a huge conspiracy. And I think the investigation shows it. I've written about it extensively. The kind of witnesses that these people were not, they were top lawyers. And they knew who to call, but they didn't call some of the closest witnesses. They never even located people. Like if you look at some of the witnesses that were early favorites of the conspiracy people, Umbrella Man, the guy that was out there pumping an umbrella down on a sunny day, never identified, never called. Later, they belatedly produced this guy, Stephen Witt, who obviously wasn't him. And ironically, he mentioned Joe Kennedy Sr. and said he was out there protesting his appeasement policies with Neville Chamberlain. Like anybody in 1963 would even know what those umbrellas are.
Yeah.
I mean, it's ridiculous. Obviously absurd. But that's their explanation. They never identified him. They never identified the babushka lady. You can see her. She was wearing like a Russian scarf called a babushka. Nobody knows who she was. And the authorities never attempted. She's seen filming with a nice looking motion picture camera. She's on the other side of the street. So she would have gotten the grassy knoll, maybe the 6th floor window in the background as well.
And she wasn't she one of the only people who really didn't react typically. I mean, wouldn't a lot of people?
Well, Umbrella Man certainly didn't. And his family, they sat down. She didn't see. I don't know what she. I think she's milling around afterwards with the rest of the people. But the important thing is that she had the best view by far. She had a much closer view from the other side than Zapruder. Her footage would have been invaluable. They never even attempted to find her. No one has really seen the Babushka Ladies film. And of course, that brings to question the other curious factor that day. As Vince Palarama, you know, told me, and you study this in depth, usually in the other motorcades, the press car was filming these motorcades, and they were in front of JFK's limousine and filming him. They weren't there that day.
Yeah.
There were seven. They were in a bus, like seven, eight cars back. So that's why when you see it, that's why we had to rely on Abraham Zapruder and Marie Muchmore and Orville Nix, because there was no professional footage. And that's, you know, really odd, to say the least, because you look at his other motorcades and the rest of his trip in Dallas. I mean, he's going inside the Houston Space Center and they're filming everything he's doing in there. But they're not filming that. Basically, the professional footage stops at the airport. And one of the last things you see is that Secret Service agent throwing his arms up. After that, when it's basically people that were taking home movies. So the only reason we see anything of that motorcade is because lots of people were taking home movies. And nobody questioned that, though. And I question it.
How did Johnson become connected with Kennedy to begin with? I mean, what did Kennedy actually select him as the vice president, or were they somehow placed together?
Well, that's a good question. And it was one of those examples where it was made for political expediency. Okay. Because they understood that they needed somebody from the South to keep some of those swing Southern states. And JFK, this Boston liberal, was not going to carry a lot of those Southern states. So LBJ, especially Texas, was huge because he's from Texas. So you want those electoral votes. That's why they picked him. And there's a lot of talk about why they picked him. I mean, there's Bobby Kennedy supposedly was incensed about it, didn't want it. Other people think that LBJ was somehow he was maneuvered onto the ticket. So they announced it before JFK even approved it. And left him holding the bag. So there's now Evelyn Lincoln, who I mentioned earlier, claimed that the last time she saw JFK before he took off for Dallas, because Evelyn Lincoln did not go to Dallas with him, that he told her that LBJ was off the ticket in 64 and he was going to replace him with, I think, George Smathers of Florida. So yeah. LBJ certainly had reasons to.
Well, they just seem so ill-matched, just personality-wise. And from everything I've ever read or heard, in reality, LBJ was probably incredibly racist, said a lot of racist things, and yes. Did a lot of just completely, literally pulling out pieces, members of his body and throwing it on the table. Just ridiculous things. They don't seem
very
like those
crude.
Two. Yeah, very crude. Don't seem like those two would gel, would have normally naturally found each other and decided, you know what, we're the team that's going to get this done. It definitely seemed like they were more placed together and put together. And we are going to cut right now from the podcast as we're talking tonight. We're going to have a part two of this podcast. We're running a little bit late on this particular one. So stay tuned next week for the continuance of our history lesson on the Kennedy family with Donald Jeffries. He'll be back with us again. We'll continue our conversation, talk a little bit more through the John F. Kennedy's assassination, through Robert Kennedy, Ted Kennedy, and actually John F. Kennedy Jr., and talk about their history all the way up till basically the turn of the century. But before we go, I wanted to say that the Prove Me Wrong podcast is brought to you tonight by Zendo Zone Citronella Burners from J.T. Eaton. We have one right here, little Zendo Zone. They're shaped like fearless bug-repellent tiki gods. So let Surf and Stan, Hawaiian Howie, and Luau Lily bring the islands to your backyard with Zendo Zone Citronella Burners. Zendo Zone uses natural 3% citronella candles and incense cones. They're perfect for patios, decks, backyards, campsites, poolside, and more. You can enjoy the outdoors again. They're available on Amazon.com and Ace Hardware, so go ahead and collect yours today. By the way, if you want to contact us, you can use our Gmail account. It's provemewrongcast@gmail.com. You can also contact us through Facebook or Instagram. Prove Me Wrong is the name of the program. Just look us up on either one of those platforms. If you're looking for more ways to listen to the podcast itself, we are on basically all podcast platforms. Anchor, Spotify, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, iTunes, the Apple Store. Like and subscribe to the program. You'll be the first notified when a brand new episode is released. We typically release them once a week. We're also on Rumble.com and YouTube as well, and you can see the YouTube banner right here. So if you enjoy watching the video, we have a video broadcast as well as the audio podcast. Like and subscribe to the YouTube account, or like and subscribe to the Rumble account, and you again will be notified when a brand new episode releases. If you like what you hear, go ahead and drop us a line. Let us know in the comments section what you like, and if you have any suggestions for future shows. I'd love to hear them. So once again, for Donald Jeffries, this is Pete Lee with the Prove Me Wrong podcast. We are going to be back here again next week, finishing up our discussion regarding hidden histories of the Kennedy family. See you then.